Hello and welcome to the Tefu Climate Podcast. I'm Guillaume, your host, and each week I'm fortunate to share with you stories from climate tech founders, investors, and corporations sharing their unique insights into this fast-moving industry. Eventually, like me, you will learn, discover, and get inspired by those unique men and women who are contributing to the fight against climate change, and I hope it will help you to take a step in this formidable movement. So before we start, I just want to share a few words about us, as this podcast is just the tip of the iceberg of what we do at Startup Basecamp to support climate tech movement. Our mission is to accelerate capital deployment towards climate tech founders, allowing them to focus on scaling their solutions. How do we do that? Every day, we help founders access to resources and connections and gain the visibility they need to expand their growth. We do this in a number of ways, with a membership platform, a Slack group, with a growing number of founders, investors, and experts from around the world. And recently, we went one step further with a matching services to connect founders with top climate tech investors. Keep in mind that we are able to do all of this thanks to the support of our listeners and our members. So please like and subscribe. Share one episode with a friend, join a community, and if you haven't already done so, make a small donation to support our work. It really means the world to us. And now, enjoy the show! Hi everyone, today we speak with Mira Clark from Redpoint Ventures. Redpoint has been around since the late 90s and has partnered with the best like Stripe, Twilio, and Snowflake, to name a few. Her scope is broad, however, Mira joined a year ago to focus on building out Redpoint's footprint within the climate tech space. Mira hails from North Carolina, and she explains how her lessons from her dad, when very young, sparked her initial curiosity to care for the planet. From working in the House and Senate to finance Morgan Stanley, where she was identifying disruptive trends in the market, to VC at Obvious Venture and Norred Point, Mira talks about her propensity for action and desire to be where things are happening. In this episode, Mira deep dives into what companies have really scaled on the consumer side and how to empower and motivate the mass market to live their best lives, both personally and professionally, whilst keeping the impact of their actions on the planet in mind. She covers the importance of risk mitigation and how they, at Redpoint, assess this when considering investment for both B2B and B2C businesses, and why they are less prescriptive in their approach to measuring impact at first when considering investment at an early stage. Second part of the show, Mira shares how Redpoint focuses on team and time and how to demonstrate you build velocity. She gives her advice on building longitudinal relationships with investors and tells us about her secret recipe for success. Mira, welcome to the show. Hi, Mira. Welcome to the Tech for Climate podcast. I'm super happy to have you here with us today. I'm looking forward to this great opportunity to hear your story and get up to speed on what you guys are looking at with Redpoint Venture, which is partner with visionary founders and to create new markets and redefine existing ones. I have to say the firm invested in very successful companies across the years. I read like 465 companies with 140 IPOs, so congrats on that, like Twilio, Zendesk, Netflix, and others, which is super interesting because it sounds that you guys are also moving into the climate space, and that's really, really something very promising for everybody because we need more investors like yours as well to join and support the game. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to be here.
So as we always start in the show, we'd like to get a 30-second intro about Redpoint Ventures and maybe a little bit more on the specific on the climate space as well.
Absolutely. Redpoint as a fund has been around from quite some time. We actually got our start in 1999. So over the past several decades, we've had the true honor of partnering with the likes of Stripe or Snowflake or Twilio or Ramp, fairly broad in scope across consumer, infrastructure, enterprise, you name it. And as you alluded to, I joined the firm a year ago to continue building out our footprint within climate specifically. As we think about our role in the climate conversation, which I have little doubt we will unpack further, in the coming conversation, we're really focused on driving that mass adoption, bringing a far larger base of consumers and enterprises into the fold, because that's what we really believe needs to happen and needs to exist for us to drive true change at kind of a societal or global level. And so, yeah, excited to unpack this and more this morning.
Definitely, we'll do that. But before we go into the details of that, we'd like to hear a bit more about you as a person. In this show, it's always about first, who is the guest speaker? So what are you passionate about? I mean, what do you do besides, working, investing, supporting into those founders? I mean, what makes you feel inspired or like your best self, as I always say, like, who is Mira?
Yeah.
Big question.
I'd be curious to hear the answers from the various members of my team. But I think, when you think about whatever we want to call it, millennial, Gen Z entitlement, I had this belief going into my career, and maybe it was delusional, that I really wanted to spend my Tuesdays the same way that I spend my Saturdays. And that's unpacking those areas that I just cannot get enough of, and that I'm thinking about all the time. And when it really comes down to what that is, for me, it's empowering consumers to live their best lives, whether that's personally or professionally. And as we sort of think about what that means and what enables that, taking a 50-year view or even taking a 5-year view, the planet is playing a greater and greater role in that conversation. It's interesting. I grew up in the Southeast. I grew up in North Carolina. And my parents were a little bit unconventional. I remember my first moment of, wow, you should really think about the planet. And this is probably TMI, but I was walking to the bus and my dad was behind me and I stepped in dog poop. And I had a paper towel with me, coincidentally. And so kind of like wiped it off as I was going to the bus, tossed it to the side. And my dad calls me at school on my little, I'm 12-year-old cell phone. And it's like, Mira, I'm calling the cops on you. You are going to jail. And I was like, what have I done? And he's like, you've littered. And like, I have evidence of it. I'm going to be the witness. And did this like whole spiel. And, I'm crying. I'm stressed. I was someone that didn't want to get in trouble. And that for me was this first like moment, for whatever reason, of we have this responsibility. And it's not something that we adopt when it's convenient or when it feels cool. It's something that we really need to carry with us, every moment of our lives. I think living in the Bay Area today, it's something we certainly feel more and more, whether it's with, the fire seasons that we've been having as of late, or the extreme rains or winds that we've had over the past several months. But to me, it's really thinking about, how can we create a world that's better for everyone, better for you, better for me, better for our children? As investors, as innovators, as operators, as we think about what role we need to play over the coming quarters or coming years, I think, that role in the climate conversation is one that we simply can't ignore.
So tell us a bit more about your different work and life experience prior to Redpoint Venture. I mean, I saw that you were like a part of the more traditional finance, and then you worked in the VC firm. But what did you learn during that journey that in a way gave you an edge to join the firm and be a little bit more into this specific of climate, tech in general? Do you have any, maybe one or two key moment or piece of experience that you would like to share?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like I've always had a little bit of this propensity for action or this desire to be where things are happening. And so, potentially naively, when I was in high school, I really actually gravitated towards the world of politics, which you wouldn't see on my LinkedIn per se or my resume per se. But I actually spent 2 summers interning in the House and in the Senate, or on a Senate campaign, for members of both the Republican and Democratic parties, because I was just kind of curious as to how things got done there. And For better or for worse, during my time there, I realized that while politicians talk a lot, the action's really happening in the private sector. And so that's what led me to kind of begin my exploration in the private sector and tech specifically, which is even in and of itself been a little bit of a winding journey. While I was in school, I, you know, had, you know, the honor of going through that academic exploration at Stanford, and so was surrounded by so many of these ideas or questions that I just didn't have access to growing up. And landing at Stanford, everyone was talking about tech. And so I kind of had this aha moment of, great, I'll go work in tech. So the summers after, you know, my first few years, I actually spent time interning at startups. I was at an e-commerce startup for a summer doing marketing. I was at a publicly traded fintech company for a summer doing product. And began to ask these questions of, where does my company sit within this industry? And where is this industry going in 5 years? And didn't necessarily feel that I, as this lowly intern, was necessarily equipped to answer those questions or was necessarily surrounded by people that were looking to answer them. And so that's what actually led me to sort of gravitate closer and closer towards the world of finance. My first job within finance was actually at Morgan Stanley. I interned there the summer after my junior year and landed there full time. Post-college. And my first job at the firm was on a desk called the cross-asset desk. So I was sitting within equities, but looking at public equity and credit markets, effectively identifying disruptive trends in the markets. Let's say the evolution of the automotive industry as we moved to EVs, fleets, autonomous vehicles, what have you, and thinking through ways to trade around these themes across equity and credit markets. Think a semiconductor stock within equities, auto ABS in the credit markets. And while I loved that job and intellectually it was quite stimulating, what I realized is that a lot of the innovation itself was happening in the private sector. And so I really wanted to be closer to those companies that were really changing the world that we live in. So kind of with that, you know, itch, if you will, I made the move slightly earlier, though still sitting within the context of the bank. I moved over to the firm's tech banking practice where I was working with, you know, a lot of these companies that were IPOing or doing, you know, late stage private placements, if you will. And kind of with that skill set, made my first foray into investing, working in the firm's accelerator, investing off balance sheet in women and multicultural founders, which I think, again, really speaks to this desire to invest in the world that we believe exists, before finally leaving Morgan Stanley to join the world of institutional investing with my first job in venture. My first job on the institutional investing side was at a fund called Obvious Ventures, so mission-driven venture capital fund and B Corp, similarly based in the Bay Area. That was investing in climate, let's say before we called it climate, and certainly before it was cool. Had a blast at Obvious, and I think back then, a lot of what was happening in this ecosystem specifically was more on the, you know, hardware, deep tech, you know, true scientific discovery side of things. Think companies like Beyond Meat or Proterra or Lilium and everything in between. And as we, over the past few years, have sort of seen this generational transition or this next chapter in the world of climate tech, moving towards some of these more software-oriented solutions, platforms that enable, you know, more adoption at the societal level or kind of from the masses, to me, that really created this opportunity to bring, you know, funds like a Redpoint into the climate conversation with investments that, let's say, a little bit more closely mirror our underwriting strategy here. And so that's been something I've really had the honor and pleasure of unpacking over the past 12 months.
So prior to this interview, we had this little conversation, and we're kind of like trying to understand like which, you know, more like sectorial approach we would like to take before diving into Redpoint and the firms. And you raised a point that, and I thought that was very interesting, is to understand a little bit more like about like the state of decarbonization of what we call Middle America, and its potential in a way to contribute to the effort of the US in the fight of against climate change. So I think I'd like to, you know, cover that point and deep dive a little bit in that sector, try to understand maybe at first if you could, you know, tell us a little bit more, like give us this overview of this Middle America carbon appetite landscape. You know, what are the different type of like greenhouse gas sources that you guys have identified are really like specific to Middle America today? I mean, I know that not everybody is driving EVs in that area. But tell us more about that. I mean, if you could share some data points and the sectors and like the quantity of greenhouse gas that it represents at the US level, and why does it matter?
Yeah. So I think maybe before even unpacking that, it's important to understand, you know, why we care about the non-San Francisco or non-New York coastal elite. And I think so much of my thinking or my approach to investing comes from this core, you know, consumer interest or sort of learning over, you know, the course of history, what companies have really scaled on the consumer side. And as we think about, you know, the Pinterests of the world or the Facebooks of the world or the Snapchats of the world, they were not used by venture capitalists. You look at kind of their early user data, and sure, maybe, you know, Facebook was at Harvard, Snap was at Stanford, but a lot of their user base, even in the early days, was really spread across the map. And as we think about how do you build a multi-billion dollar company or kind of a category defining or generation defining company, it needs to be adopted across society. It's not simply siloed in kind of these high income areas. And so kind of taking that approach or that belief in terms of what builds a big business and then marrying it with the magnitude of the climate crisis, right? And the size or scope of these problems that we need to address, getting 100 people to participate or getting 1 million people to participate candidly is not enough. And so it's how do we incentivize or encourage or motivate these folks to come into the conversation or become agents for change in the same way that maybe you or I are motivated to do. As we think about what motivates them, candidly, it's probably a little bit different than you or different than me. You know, they aren't focused on what is my, you know, what is the methane emission from the burger that's on my plate. They want to eat and they like the taste of the burger and it's cheap, so they're eating it. And so as we sort of think about what are the points of motivation for them. And when I say them, I don't actually just mean consumers. I mean both consumers, you know, in their homes, at their schools, but also consumers when they're at the office. You know, these corporations that are based, again, outside of the Bay Area, outside of New York, their consideration set is very different than folks in our backyard. And so as I think about what really motivates, you know, these three bodies, I think about three primary drivers, and these are kind of the three boxes or three questions I'm looking to answer when I'm looking at a new company. One is, can I make more money? Whether that's a corporate bringing in more revenue because I'm able to sell into more customers, or whether that's a consumer that is able to get a rebate or cash back for what they're doing. So kind of this, you know, income generating opportunity is point one. Point two for me is, if I can't generate income, can I at least save money? And so again, for a company that might be reducing the cost of their inputs, reducing their energy bills. And similarly for a consumer, you know, with, you know, energy bills going here, there, and everywhere over the past 12 months, not only in the US, but also in Europe, given the geopolitical dynamics we've actually been dealing with, having a little bit less volatility and a little bit more predictability surrounding what your costs or what your inputs will be for us is really interesting, because that's not even a climate sale. That's just good business sense as a consumer or as a corporate customer. And finally, which I think is very important, though rather unfortunate, is this question of risk mitigation, both near-term risk and longer-term risk. As the costs of, you know, climate change continue to accelerate at, I think what you and I can agree is a somewhat alarming pace, really thinking through, how do I think about analyzing that risk? You know, supply chain vulnerabilities, insurance vulnerabilities, what have you, and are there ways for me to either mitigate that by dual sourcing materials, using more resilient materials or what have you, or by at least pricing in or offsetting that risk in some way? I think it's quite interesting. And so as we sort of think about the, you know, forces of change, while we would love for everyone to be motivated by this desire to do well for the planet, we really want this kind of 1-2 punch of like, yes, it's good. Yes, it's the right thing to do. But also, here's why you simply cannot afford to ignore it, because it is so obviously a beneficial decision for you. So that's a lot of what we are thinking about when we're investing in either B2B or B2C businesses.
Okay, and I get, I think, and thanks for sharing this, like those forces that really matters, but what does it represent? I mean, why does it matter to really like start to push, I would call quote unquote middle America to change the way how they operate today in terms of like impact on climate? I mean, why does it matter? What is like the magnitude of like that specific, I would say, scope or, piece of the pie that it represents at the US level? And then where are the places, I would say, like where you see that technologies or solution could be applied? I mean, what are the low-hanging fruit that are there that can directly have like a potential like high impact, but at the same time fit into those forces that will then go at scale as you're hoping for?
Absolutely. So, I kind of think of this in maybe two ways. One is, what is the scope of the problem, or like, what do we need to address? And then two, what commitments have we made and how do we kind of uphold that? In terms of the scope of the problem, right, I think a lot of these real estate numbers get thrown around, but let's say roughly 40% of, emissions are coming from real estate, whether that's residential, commercial. That is huge. And, I think putting a map of where the population lives across the US or across the world, it is not exclusively in major metropolitan areas. And as we think about folks that, have perhaps been a little bit slower to move to solar or move to renewable sources of energy, that's really where we need to address the issue. And so as we think about, driving that true step change in terms of the emissions footprint of, this country specifically, let's just take the US for a moment, it's really bringing all of those other folks into the fold. What is interesting today is that, again, it actually makes economic sense for them on, let's say two and a half fronts. One, I think globally, we're seeing a lot of support from governments, right, as it relates to providing subsidies for that initial CapEx investment, really easing that transition or making it the obvious choice. But even longer term, as we think about the cost of energy, it's actually cheaper in many instances to use renewables. And particularly, again, with a lot of this volatility in the energy markets, they might be a little bit better today than they were 6 months ago. But who knows what's going to happen next year or the following year or the following year. And so I think having a little bit more agency and predictability about the cost of your energy footprint, whether you're a consumer living paycheck to paycheck or whether you're a corporate looking to have margin visibility for your shareholders, I think that's hugely important. So that would be point one. Point two is looking at the Fortune 500, right? In many ways, they are the ones that are, carrying the flag for, as companies, we are going to drive, meaningful improvement in the way that we think about protecting our planet. These folks, while well-intentioned, I think have been a little rash, and I mean slow to react, but also rash in a way, in that a large percentage of them, like approaching 50%, we're not there yet, but I think it'll happen, have made commitments to net zero targets. And these commitments are coming up far faster than I think any of them anticipated. And as you and I know, getting to net zero is hard. It's not an overnight change. And what I think a lot of these corporates are realizing is that this isn't for them just installing solar on their roof or thinking about printing a little bit less when they're, circulating presentations. What it really means for them is thinking about their Scope 3 footprint. And when we think about that Scope 3 footprint, we then start thinking about their suppliers and their business services providers. And this is what I think is really interesting, because that's where the conversation shifts from the most powerful boardrooms in the country to the masses, because they are now, based on what we're hearing, now requiring their business services providers and their suppliers to disclose these metrics. And I suspect with some of these regulations, we'll see what the SEC comes out with. Obviously, Europe was leading the way with what came to market or came to light rather in Q4, we're going to see a lot more required Scope 3 disclosure, which I think is quite interesting. Take law firms, for example, where a recent stat I heard, though maybe don't quote me on it, is that 83% of law firms in the U.S. in 2022 were required to complete some sort of ESG-related disclosure in an RFP. Again, we're seeing that across industries, whether it's marketing, accounting, law, PR. And what that means is that regardless of whether you care about the planet, regardless of whether you even really believe in climate change, God forbid, it means that you have to kind of start thinking about these things now and addressing these things now. And so as we think about this next wave of change or this next, you know, chapter of the conversation, that's what we are really focused on, because these are teams that don't have sophisticated or robust sustainability teams or sustainability programs in-house, but that are really looking for easy-to-use, intuitive plug-and-play solutions where I think software and technology can actually play a really interesting role.
Do you see any subsectors or categories in that whole, pie, that are really complicated and difficult to decarbonize and that will come after, after this necessary tailwind that you have with all the regulation, the IRA and stuff like that, pushing those organizations to change? But do you see a typical, the focus today is really how to decarbonize Middle America, where are the different pockets where you see it's excessively difficult and will take longer to achieve more cleaner or decarbonized, process, way of production or services or whatsoever?
Yeah. It's really hard to fix what you can't measure because you don't have those baselines and you don't really know the scope of the problem or what exactly you're working on. And so I think in many instances, it's very achievable or very mappable to address some of these, smaller scale projects or areas where you have full data visibility, whether that's the footprint of your home or the footprint of your small business. Where I think this becomes much harder and where this becomes much more of a global conversation and a longer term conversation is when it comes to our global supply chains. And you think about materials, ingredients, where, data visibility from Asia, Africa, South America, you name it, becomes paramount. And I think data integrity and real-time data visibility historically in these regions has been hard, whether it's due to, lack of dependable connectivity, lack of technological infrastructure, lack of awareness. They have a lot of competing priorities. And so I think that's where, there's a ton of opportunity, but there's also a ton of challenge. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see over the coming quarters and years, right? Because in many ways, the largest companies in the world, Apple, Nike, Inditex, you name it, have extreme reliance on these regions as well, right? They are truly global businesses. And so I think it'll be quite interesting to see how some of these, smaller scale producers or manufacturers or suppliers are brought into the conversation and required to up-level their systems to kind of meet this growing need.
So to close this this section, according to you, what are the U.S. advantages and weaknesses in regard of innovation and production that will lead to this decarbonizing, Middle America and more at a larger scale? How do you compare U.S. versus maybe China or the EU? You mentioned EU at the beginning of the conversation. Do you see major difference advantages on one side, weaknesses? How would you wrap these up?
Yeah, if we all thought about climate change like the EU, we'd probably be in a far better place. But maybe that's just wishful thinking for now. No, I think in many ways to, view the glass half full, the US has been very inspired by the work that's being done in Europe. And I think Europe has, taken a very honorable role of really serving as the global leader in terms of what needs to happen. What makes me excited about the US is probably threefold. One is the fact that the government means business. And this is not just the federal government. I think it's very easy to, look at White House headlines or congressional headlines and say, great, the IRA is throwing gobs of money at this. But it's actually so much more than that. And some of the most powerful, you know, force multipliers of change we're actually seeing at the state and municipal level. I might be a little bit biased living in California and seeing all of the work that we've done as it relates to, you know, prohibiting the sale of new internal combustion engines in the not too distant future, kind of thinking about the way that we cap emissions at a per building level, thinking about, you know, how the state is now mandating processing of food waste or kind of the use of food waste or handling of food waste. So I think the U.S. is seeing a lot of regulatory or policy tailwinds that I think are really propelling us forward. And, you know, the U.S., for better or for worse, is very incentivized by money. And so I think the, you know, close to $400 billion we're throwing at this problem as it relates to the IRA. And I think in some estimates, look at what Goldman has put out, far, far more than that over time. I think that is huge for us and really, you know, is a big advantage we didn't have 10 years ago or kind of thinking back to the clean tech 1.0 era. Two is the fact that the U.S. really has this, you know, propensity for change or this excitement for innovation at its core. You look at the role that we've played in the global tech ecosystem, and we are pretty good at building startups and scaling startups. And so for me, that's really exciting because I think it will not just be incumbents that are fixing this. It will be, you know, new companies coming in to solve a lot of these challenges. And I think the U.S. has proven itself, along with many global partners, of course, that we are good at that. And finally, the thing that maybe warms my heart the most or excites me the most looking at my own backyard is that so many of the brightest minds in our network here at Redpoint, my network from Stanford, kind of folks I see on the internet, are all moving towards climate. It is in many ways unprecedented in terms of the caliber and volume of talent moving with such speed into one ecosystem. And so to me, you know, though perhaps not someone that says we should always throw bodies at the problem, if you are going to throw the brightest minds in the world at an issue or at an open question, I can't think of a better question that we'd be looking to answer. So for me, that is incredibly encouraging in particular as I think about the role that the U.S. will hopefully play over the coming years.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this and this larger, you know, view and in those market change and forces that you guys are seeing. So let's go into the specifics of Redpoint Venture now. Can you just maybe a little bit more about like the genesis of this growing interest of on the climate tech, you know, space and sectors that as a traditional VC firm now, you're also like looking at. What is the initial gap that you saw that led to behind the thesis today?
Absolutely. It's funny. I'm going to answer this question as it relates to climate, though I think so many of what I'm saying, if you copy-pasted climate with AI, many of the answers would be the exact same. But as we think about climate, not as a category, but actually much more so as a theme, we look at just the volume of dollars that have gone into it, right? Looking back at 2022 data, for example, or looking at kind of some data out of PwC as at least a single data point, roughly $1 in $4 across the venture ecosystem went into climate tech, broadly defined, last year, which is huge. It's so rare that we see that across any theme. And so in my mind, that means that it's really impossible to ignore if you are a fund of our size or a fund with our ambitions, one. Two, kind of thinking through where will the next generation defining businesses exist or kind of where are there opportunities to return candidly billions of dollars. Climate, I think, is an incredibly compelling opportunity from an investment perspective. And to earn the right to invest in a sector, you need to deeply understand it. You need to have those relationships. And most importantly, you need to have the ability to truly advise and support startups. And so whether these companies are started in, you know, 2020 or 2030, it's really an investment in building out our practice. And so I think that's what's led us to really double down in a very concerted way in terms of the work that we are doing in climate. Finally, as we think about, you know, what that looks like we don't think it's going to be, you know, a siloed technology, if you will. We think it will infiltrate every single corner of the economy, whether that's the way we think about building a data center, whether that's the way we think about building a home, whether that's the way we think about analyzing our supply chain, underwriting insurance premiums, driving investment decisions. And so having a little bit more of a holistic view for us is incredibly important because, again, I think it's a question or I think it's a variable we are going to need to consider in almost every one of our investments down the line, which for me is really encouraging because I think it speaks to the amount of momentum that's really propelling this category or this conversation forward.
So you mentioned in your point too that you want to like, I mean, the idea is like also supporting founders. And I think that's something that matters a lot for founders. Like, you know, cash is one thing very important to keep the ball rolling and scaling your company. But also when you partner with an investors, you want this relationship where they can bring even more than just the cash. So what do you offer to those founders that join and you know that you invest in? I mean, what are the challenges maybe that you see that are specific to climate tech founders versus the traditional tech founders in the that you guys were used to invest and support prior to that?
Yeah. So I think the role that, you know, we are playing or we aspire to play in the climate tech ecosystem is interesting because so much of this category over the past decade has really been supported by climate-specific funds, and that's fantastic. That said, these funds, not always, but these funds at times can be capped in their fund size. And so as we think about non-pre-seed seed and non, you know, late stage growth, capital availability, I think there is a really interesting gap. Let's say between Series A, Series B, where we are kind of entering the conversation. And so I think one, to your point, it's the, yeah, getting the capital. And then equally as importantly, or more importantly, to your point, it's the, what support do we provide these founders with? As we think about where we have gravitated within climate tech, it has been towards areas where we feel like we can provide the most value, those primarily being software infrastructure, and that would be digital infrastructure, just to clarify, marketplaces and financing solutions, because those are the sorts of traditional tech businesses that we've backed. And that is where over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, we've built out a fairly robust founder experience effort or portfolio services platform, as you think about it, at a lot of traditional funds or at a lot of our peer funds. Our founder experience team is actually as large as our early stage investment team. And the way that we approach, which is, you know, making 12 to 14 new investments a year that we want to partner with for the next 12 to 14 years, is actually very concentrated relative to the size of our team. And so what that means is that, yeah, we have a lot of time to dedicate to each of these companies, which is one of the most fun parts of the job, candidly. As we think about where we can really support climate tech companies, I think there's probably three areas that are top of mind for me and that are also complemented by the founder experience teams that we've built out. One is on the hiring side. I think climate tech is one of those ecosystems where you truly need an interdisciplinary team, right? Maybe a founder is coming from more of a PhD background or from more of a traditional science, policy, or academia background, but bringing in, you know, that tech talent from Stripe, from Square, from Google is also quite critical as you think about having that build velocity in-house or that go-to-market motion. And so we think a lot about supporting our companies, not only with org design, but also making those hires. So that would be point one. Point two for me is maybe like 2A, 2B, or you can just call it 2 and 3, is this question around go-to-market to the whole, you know, overarching theme of how do we bring this to the masses? You know, so many of these founders are great at getting their idea from 0 to 1. And so what we really want to help them with is getting it from 1 to beyond. And we kind of think about that in 3 buckets. If you were just to say, what are these possible go-to-market motions? One is really, you know, more traditional marketing that B2C motion. Maybe that's thinking through your social viral strategy, where we have, you know, in-house experts, or we play around on TikTok for those of those in your audience that hang out there. Two would be a little bit more of that similarly organic motion, but more at the enterprise scale. So think about product-led growth. What does that mean? How do we think about messaging and marketing that propels your product into that sort of PLG flywheel? And how do we think about maintaining / accelerating that flywheel over time? And then finally is more traditional enterprise SaaS. And I think there's a lot to unpack there. You could probably do a whole episode on that. And we're actually, you know, continuing to put out content on that side too. But on the traditional enterprise SaaS side, we're thinking about anything from org design, setting those KPIs, thinking about, you know, what does your ICP look like? Why does it look that way? How does this evolve over time? But also thinking about those customer introductions, thinking about, you know, introducing founders to the Redpoint network, or kind of facilitating, yeah, those warm handoffs for those commercial conversations and providing them with support throughout the process. And so I think that's the benefit of, you know, having a fund like Redpoint alongside a climate tech fund on some of these cap tables or in the conversation, where perhaps they are much closer on a specific regulatory policy or a very specific, you know, relationship within the world of climate. But I think we, you know, aspire to complement that with a little bit more of the traditional tech perspective, because I do think to reach, you know, true scale, it's going to take both sides of the coin.
So which are the sectors that, according to you, are the most promising today in terms of what I call the ICR or impact cash returns? I mean, meaning building, like, you know, impactful companies while creating highly profitable business. Do you have like maybe one or two examples of like any, you know, subsectors or underdogs area that you are specifically excited about right now?
Yeah. One, I think, would be I will say this broadly so that I can kind of sneak two areas into one, but one would be the real estate electrification transition. Some of that's at the residential level and some of that's at the commercial level. Given, you know, the magnitude of emissions across these two parties, and a lot of financial incentives, whether that's rebates or or fines, I think there's a huge amount of opportunity there. And a lot of those solutions, as we think about building a true moat or true defensibility, is going to come from a data play. And so I think we're quite excited about that broader ecosystem, one. Two, we're spending a lot more time thinking about the supply chain and what role the supply chain conversation plays in the broader climate conversation. You know, as I alluded to earlier, it's really freaking hard. And it's a huge challenge, but I think as a lot of companies now are rethinking how they approach their supply chain, whether it's due to, you know, climate-related disruptions, geopolitical pressures that they've experienced over the past couple of years, I think it's a really interesting time, a really unique opportunity to change the way that, you know, people are approaching it. And so supply chain is definitely somewhere else that we're spending a lot of time. And then finally is on this risk analysis or risk mitigation question. I think, you know, this year feels like it's been the craziest winter on record, whether it's tornadoes or winds or rains or snowstorms. But unfortunately, there's a real risk that it only gets worse from here. And so as companies think about combating that, or, you know, at least hedging themselves against those costs, I think there's an interesting role that, similarly from a data analytics perspective or a predictive modeling perspective, there's a really interesting role that technology can play with solutions that on the surface maybe not labeled as, you know, climate for X or climate analytics, but underneath the hood, that's really what's driving their use case and their need in the world today.
I like to take also the opposite side. What are the, you know, the I would say, according to your own opinion, like the solution that you believe makes no sense whatsoever, or sounds like, you know, they may be a waste of time or resources, or even maybe like greenwashing? Do you have like any examples of things that you're not excited about right now?
Yeah. I don't know. That's such a hard question for me, because in many ways, I think that all of these solutions, or the vast majority of these solutions, do play a role, because I think in so many ways, even having the conversation is critical to building momentum across the broader movement. I do struggle a little bit with some of the carbon markets and the ways that we think about accounting there. I think, you know, it's great from a marketing perspective, and you can tell a very simple story, but sometimes that story is a little bit too simplified. And particularly folks that are, you know, maybe a little bit more critical of the category or looking to weaponize some of the areas of weaknesses, I think there's a lot of risk there. And so my hope is that we do become a little bit more truth-seeking or data-driven in what, you know, the magnitude of the change those solutions are driving really looks like. And who knows, we might even see, again, some policy or regulatory pressures come in that create a little bit more clarity. But I think that's one area that, while I'm not angry it exists, or, you know, I'm not bothered by the fact that it exists, I do have a little bit of concern, or it does keep me up at night a little bit, kind of thinking through how does this play out, and what blind spots or delusions does this create as it picks up momentum.
Speaking about the impact, we have a lot of like climate tech funds passing by the shows. You guys are like, how do you measure impact? I mean, in comparison to other funds, you do not mention any specific criteria in terms of like, you know, emission reduction or avoidance, or maybe like, you know, social impact. I mean, how do you go about that? Do you have any like frameworks or assessment, or do you rely on like you know, team of scientists to kind of like assess where there is like something there, or is it something that, as you invest more on the early stage spectrum of it, it's something that needs to be defined and refined alongside the road?
Yeah, you know, it's not something we measure, and I would say in many ways it's something we intentionally don't measure. I think, one, it's really hard to know, you know, when you're investing at seed Series A, what these companies are going to look like at Series D, Series E. And so I think in some ways we are cognizant of the risk of false precision. And so as these companies kind of evolve in their orientation, we want to be students of where they're going. And so I think we think a lot more about intention or kind of, you know, longer term impact versus what did you just do today, one. Two, I think the companies we're investing in are early, and they have limited teams and finite resources and are on a race against the clock until their next fundraise, or are, you know, racing to the finish line against a competitor to launch or acquire that customer or whatever it is. And so we're also very aware of wanting to support companies while not distracting them. And I think one of the challenges that can come, not always, but can come from, you know, somewhat onerous reporting requirements at the investor level can be distracting them or slowing them down. And the last thing we want to do is to, you know, inhibit their growth or get in their way. And so we also think a lot about that in terms of how do we set them up, or, you know, as we live in service to our founders, how do we, do everything that we can to set them up for success? And so I would say that's another element of kind of why I think we are less prescriptive in the reporting side. But yeah, I think it's an interesting dynamic, because in some ways it means we are investing a little bit with this, you know, fuzzier essence of faith in the fact that they're moving the movement forward, or they're, you know, truly driving change. And a lot of them will, right, come out, whether it's with their annual report or quarterly reports of, you know, we've offset X amount, or we've touched X number of, you know, consumers, or whatever it is. And so we're getting more and more data points as these companies mature. But yeah, I would say at this very moment, it's a little bit more of an art than a science.
So what's next for Redpond Ventures?
I would say more of the same, which sounds like such a boring answer, but it actually makes me so incredibly excited about the opportunity at hand. I think as we sort of look at the market today, I think in many ways there's never been a better time to invest in early stage companies. We're seeing, you know, more driven, resilient, grittier founders looking to tackle humanity's greatest challenges. We're seeing fewer competitors getting funded, which leads to fewer distractions around them. And we're seeing a lot of incredible talent that is looking to move the stage from public companies to startups, or from late stage startups to earlier stage companies. And so in many ways, I think there truly has never been a better time to build. And I think Redpoint over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years has sort of invested and very deliberately kind of curated this next phase of Redpoint. And I think all of these funds go through cycles, whether it's the investors at the helm, the themes we're investing behind, or what have you. And so, yeah, I really couldn't be more excited about the folks I get to surround myself with every day, and the areas that we're individually and collectively exploring.
Last question on my side, and that's a question that I ask to every interviewee and guest on the show. What's your personal view on the climate crisis? I mean, what would you say to people who feel demoralized by all the terrible and already visible consequences of climate change? I mean, are we doomed?
We might be doomed. I hope we're not doomed. No, I think as someone that is, you know, inherently optimistic, what I would tell folks is to talk to Gen Z. We're beginning the very early innings of coming up with a report, so more to come later this summer and early fall, kind of unpacking the perceptions, motivations, dreams, concerns of that next generation. And I think, you know, across the board, whether it's across states in the U.S. or across countries globally, there's no issue that's more top of mind for them than the climate crisis. And so for me, yeah, that's really encouraging. And my hope is that they certainly save us all, you know, with our support, of course, at their backs. But that's what, yeah, gives me encouragement, or kind of keeps me going with this belief that it does get better, or it does at least get manageable, despite, you know, so much of this gunk that we've all contributed to building up over far too long.
So how can the community of investors, founders, LPs, experts around the world listening to the show can help you?
Send us amazing companies and share feedback. I think we are always looking to learn from the brightest minds, you know, around the world. And that can be through discussion, that can be through debate. And so we love it when folks question our ideas, because I think it makes us a lot sharper, or it introduces us to new information or new data that, you know, perhaps are blind spots. So yeah, we encourage the feedback, we encourage the conversation. Yeah. And thank you again for having me. This has been such a treat.
Any question that I should have asked and I did not for this first part of the interview?
No, I think that covers it.
Thank you so much, Mira, for your time and your very incredible and interesting insights. I'm so excited to see so many brilliant people like you and brilliant mind putting so much time and effort to move the world towards a better future. So thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks so much
for having
me. Thanks
again for joining us on the Tech for Climate podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. Stay tuned next week for more climate tech insights. In the meantime, head on over to our webpage at startupbasecamp.org, where we have lots more insights and resources for anyone wanting to get involved in climate tech. If you find our resources useful, please consider donating to support our small self-funded team. Don't forget to subscribe and share with your friends. And see you next time.